Sorry we were late in starting. We actually lost our gavel. So anybody out there watching, if you have the Judiciary Committee's gavel, let us know. Report it to the authorities. We have a quorum to do business today. Present for the record are Representatives Gruenberg, Anderson, myself, McGuire, Dahlstrom, Coghill, and Guerra. So we do have a quorum. We have a couple of items on the agenda today. As I discussed last week, we're going to hear an overview of Blakely. We're going to have our committee aide, Vanessa Tondini, come forward and just give a backdrop, particularly for members who were doing other things this interim and didn't get an opportunity to follow this case. So she'll go through just the background, the facts that led up to it, and why we're in the place we are. And then next we've got Sarah from Representative Samuel's office here. And Sarah Nelson will go through a brief overview of the bill that Representative Samuels and I have, which is a correction, if you will, or a way of putting the intent of our law that we had before with aggravators back into place to comport with Blakely. Then I'm going to call on Lieutenant Todd Sharp very first, not to slight anybody else, but he does have to get back to work. He's with the Alaska State Troopers, so we'll call on him first. And then I'll go to Susan Parks with the Department of Law and Linda Wilson with the Public Defender's Office. And that's all I have so far to testify. So if you are here and wish to offer testimony, go ahead and sign in outside their sheets or let Vanessa know. So without, and I think I did not mention the House bill number is 78. Okay, so with that, Ms. Tondini.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Vanessa Tondini, staff to Representative McGuire. And as the Chair stated, I'm just going to give you a brief background on the facts of the Blakely case, which is, again, for the record, Ralph Howard Blakely Jr. v. Washington Supreme Court case, and the site is 124 Supreme Court 2531, and it was decided June 24th, 2004. Just to give everyone a background on what we're talking about here, I'm just going to quote from an article by Benjamin Witz. It should be in your bill packet. It's entitled Suspended Sentencing. And a brief excerpt I'll just quote here. For most of the nation's history, sentencing was a matter for judges alone. Congress set the range of punishments a crime should carry, and judges decided how, with that range, to impose those punishments. The result was huge racial, regional, and other disparities in sentencing for comparable offenses, disparities that often reflected the oddities of individual jurists. Congress responded with the Sentencing Reform Act of 1984, which sought to make sentencing more predictable. Under the sentencing guidelines that resulted, judges were compelled to plug a variety of factors into a complex formula that would provide a sentencing range. Then the counter-revolution to this began in 2000 with a case called Apprendi v. New Jersey. And Apprendi involved a state hate crimes law that allowed judges to impose sentences beyond the usual maximum if racial animus lay behind the crime. In that case, a man who had fired a gun into a black family's house was sentenced to 12 years in prison, 2 years more than the maximum for firearm possession. The court, however, struck down the sentence because the defendant's racial motivation had not been proved to the jury. Rather, it had been found by a judge. And quoted from the case, other than the fact of a prior conviction, the court held, any fact that increases the penalty for a crime beyond the prescribed statutory maximum must be submitted to a jury and proved beyond a reasonable doubt. The theory behind Apprendi seems both simple and attractive. A fact that pushes sentences above the statutory maximum for the offense is really an element of a more serious crime, and every element of a crime has traditionally had to be proved to a jury. But judges have always considered facts in sentencing that were not proved to a jury. So Apprendi forced the question of which sentencing factors must count as elements and which judges could still consider on their own. So in Blakely, the court answered that question. Anything that increases a sentence beyond the standard range set by law is by definition an elevant. So a judge may not consider it in sentencing unless it has been proved to a jury. So that gives you a little background. But the Blakely case itself, the facts leading up to it, I don't know if all of you have read the opinion yet. Scalia opinions are always quite interesting to read. And the facts of the case are quite entertaining as well. Petitioner Ralph Howard Blakely Jr. pled guilty to the kidnapping of his estranged wife. I don't know how much detail you'd like me to go into, but it is interesting. I'll just take a brief moment. But petitioner married his wife Yolanda in 1973, and as Justice Scalia puts it, he was evidently a difficult man to live with, having been diagnosed at various times with psychological and personality disorders, including paranoid schizophrenia. His wife ultimately filed for divorce. In 1998, he abducted her from their orchard home in Grant County, Washington, binding her with duct tape and forcing her at knife point into a wooden box in the bed of his pickup truck. In the process, he implored her to dismiss the divorce suit and related trust proceedings. When the couple's 13-year-old son, Ralphie, returned home from school, petitioner ordered him to follow in another car, threatening to harm Yolanda with a shotgun if he did not do so. Ralphie escaped and sought help when they stopped at a gas station, but petitioner continued on with Yolanda to a friend's house in Montana. He was finally arrested after the friend called the police. The state charged the petitioner with first-degree kidnapping. Upon reaching a plea agreement, however, it reduced the charge to second-degree kidnapping involving domestic violence and use of a firearm. The petitioner entered a guilty plea, admitting the elements of the second-degree kidnapping and the domestic violence and firearm allegations, but no other relevant facts. The case then proceeded to sentencing. In Washington, a second-degree kidnapping is a Class B felony. No person convicted of a Class B felony shall be punished by confinement exceeding a term of 10 years. So for the crime in which he was charged, 10 years is the statutory maximum. Other provisions of state law, however, further limited the range of sentences that a judge may impose. Washington Sentence Reform Act specifies for the petitioner's offense of a second-degree kidnapping with a firearm a standard range of 49 to 53 months. And a judge may impose a sentence above the standard range if he finds substantial and compelling reasons justifying an exceptional sentence. And the act lists aggravating factors that justify such a departure, which it recites to be illustrative rather than exhaustive. Nevertheless, a reason offered to justify an exceptional sentence can be considered only if it takes into account additional factors other than those which used in computing the standard range sentence for the offense. Pursuant to the plea agreement, the state recommended a sentence within a standard range of 49 to 53 months. After hearing Yolanda's description of the kidnapping, however, the judge rejected the state's recommendation and imposed an exceptional sentence of 90 months, which is 37 months beyond the standard maximum. He justified the sentence on the grounds that petitioner had acted with deliberate cruelty, a statutorily enumerated ground for departure in domestic violence cases. So the petitioner appealed, arguing that this sentencing procedure deprived him of his federal constitutional right to have a jury determine beyond a reasonable doubt all facts legally essential to his sentence. The State Court of Appeals in Washington affirmed, and the Washington Supreme Court denied discretionary review, and so the U.S. Supreme Court granted certiorari. And now, again, that's sort of the background of the case as far as facts go. And so the Supreme Court of the United States considered the Sixth Amendment implications here. The issue that they considered was whether these facts, the judge determining that he had acted with deliberate cruelty, in plain English, and adding on an additional sentence, whether that violated his Sixth Amendment right to a trial by jury. And the holding of the case, in short, was yes, because the facts supporting his exceptional sentence were neither admitted by the petitioner nor found by a jury, the sentence did violate his Sixth Amendment right to trial by jury. And again, the case applied the rule of Apprendi versus New Jersey that other than the fact of a prior conviction, any fact that increases the penalty for a crime beyond the prescribed statutory maximum must be submitted to a jury and proved beyond a reasonable doubt. The relevant statutory maximum for Apprendi purposes is the maximum a judge may impose based solely on the facts reflected in the jury verdict or admitted by the defendant. And the court does go on to say this case is not about the constitutionality of determinate sentencing, but only about how it can be implemented in a way that respects the Sixth Amendment. And so we are here today because in Alaska, which other people were discussing in greater detail, but our current felony sentencing statutes use the phrase presumptive term to establish a specific fixed term of imprisonment that in essence acts as both the minimum and the maximum sentence that can be imposed unless the court finds specific statutory mitigating or aggravating factors. Thus, current law attempts to specify one presumptively right sentence for all felony crimes within each class of offenses. And just as a side note, I've began to create a binder for all committee members. It's the red binder on your desk, and we will be adding to it throughout the year. But and I will also be making tabs so you can reference it. But I've included sentencing for felonies, misdemeanors, aggravators, and mitigators. Also definitions of all the mental states, and so we might reference that today. And if there's anything as we go through the year, let me know and I'll add it to the binders. So at this time, if anyone has any questions for me, I don't know if I explained everything you want to.
The chair.
Representative Bloomberg.
This is very helpful, Vanessa. But if we could maybe have in this a little copy of the Constitution, the state Constitution.
Great idea. I was, through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I was going to see if the LIO did have some available for us.
Good idea.
And also, Representative Chair and members of the committee, this case is it's very controversial. It was a 5-4 opinion, and the dissents, there's several dissents. Please take the time to read it if you haven't already, but they are, in fact, longer than the majority opinion. And so why we're here today, again, like I said, is because this left state courts, which have presumptive sentences, sentencing guidelines, just all the different methods for sentencing, it leaves them sort of in a quandary of what do we do now. And so I believe that's why Representative Samuels and McGuire have sponsored this bill to address that. So, thank you,
Vanessa. Yeah, and as if you guys, during testimony on bills on the floor and things like that, let me know. But she started this for me last year because every time I'd get on the floor, somebody would ask me the difference in mental intent, mental states, and different crimes and what were their terms and things like that. And so I thought, well, if I had a little reference point, so I thought it'd be helpful to you guys as well. But if there are things that you discover in other bills that you work on, even in the civil context as well, that you think would be helpful, let her know, and then we can all be of service to other members as well on the floor. Okay, thank you, Vanessa.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Okay, with that, we'll have Ms. Nielsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for hearing this bill today. For the record, I'm Sarah Nielsen, staff to Representative Samuels. Representative Samuels is in Washington, D.C. right now testifying on your behalf to the Senate Energy Committee. I'll just briefly outline what the bill does. As you just heard from Vanessa, the Blakely case, this bill amends the current presumptive sentencing from a set term to a range of terms to bring Alaska laws into conformity with requirements as a result of the Blakely decision. It also allows a probation officer to impose additional terms of release or supervision for offenders without further court proceeding. It allows for an additional aggravator when a defendant has prior criminal history of 5 or more Class A misdemeanor convictions. It also limits the ability of judges to order what are called periodic sentences in which the offender periodically leaves prison and then returns to prison. It also stipulates the authority of police officers to detain or arrest probationers and parolees for certain types of violations of conditions imposed by the courts or the parole board. The sponsor feels that the benefits of House Bill 78 improve sentencing by giving judges more discretion. It simplifies sentencing. It removes confusion in the aftermath of the Blakely decision, and it allows corrections to better manage the prison population by limiting the abuse of periodic sentencing. And I think you'll hear from corrections on that also. It improves public safety by clarifying that police officers have the authority to arrest violators of parole or probation. Under current statute, they do not right now. And then finally, it improves supervision of offenders by clarifying that probation officers have the authority to impose additional terms. And that's just a brief outline. I do know that there is a blank CS that you've got on your desks, and I can go over the differences between the CS and the original, because they're actually minor.
Yes, please.
And the CS comes from the Senate Judiciary, also heard an exact version of the bill, and they came up with some useful changes.
Just as far as a point of order, we know that we are not supposed to base what we do in this body on the other body's work, but in this instance, I chose to have a CS drafted for the committee to prevent further confusion, because it streamlines our work here in this committee. If we wait for that bill to come over and have a full separate hearing on it, and people don't, you know, understand the differences, I think it just takes more time. So the other body is busy working on another bill. It's coming through, and this is an opportunity just to see how it would change should we choose to adopt their version.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are four changes, and the first appears on page 2, line 7 of both bills. And the language and continuous incarceration would cause extreme hardship to the defendant's ability to pay fines or restitution was replaced with, and the defendant receives a composite sentence of not more than 2 years. And that was to address concern that people that have been sentenced for 2 years or less would still be allowed to have periodic sentencing for financial hardship, say fishing during a certain season. The second change is page 3, line 14. This was actually a technical change. We replaced within with lower than. That was just a drafting error. And then the third change is page 4, line 5 in the original bill, and then page 4, line 6 of the CS. We inserted orally and to ensure that there be no question that the defendant doesn't understand what's going on. And then the final change is the last line of both bills, which changed the effective date to make it immediately effective. That's so that there's no question about any crimes that are committed now, and it's a problem right now. There's sentencing problems right now. So those are the changes.
Okay, questions for Ms. Nielsen? Hearing none, stand by. Lieutenant Todd Sharp is here.
Good afternoon. I'm Lieutenant Todd Sharp with the Alaska State Troopers. I've been a state trooper for 15 years here in Alaska. I've been stationed in Soldotna, Sitka, Fairbanks, Dutch Harbor, and now here in Juneau. I'm honored to have this opportunity to speak on behalf of law enforcement. This portion of the legislation today I'd like to talk about deals with allowing police officers to detain and arrest parolees and probationers, so mostly that specific portion. I believe that many people in the state would be under the impression, as we right now, that police officers would have the ability to arrest a parolee or a probationer who violated their conditions directly. Committing a violation of these conditions would normally, you would think, mean that the immediate removal of your parole or probation privilege, but that's not the case, as stated just a moment ago. A recent Court of Appeals decision, Reichel versus State, came out in November of 2004, and it resulted in a finding that police officers do not have the authority to detain a parolee, and in this situation, it happened in Homer in October of 2001 when the police officers went to do a bar check and ended up observing Mr. Reichel in the bar. One of the police officers recognized Mr. Reichel and, in fact, had arrested him on several occasions before for parole or probation violations. Mr. Reichel left the bar and went outside. This police officer really thought that Mr. Reichel did not have the authority, or was part of his conditions of release would be, or for his parole, were that he could not go into a bar and or drink alcohol. They did see him in the bar. He left. And I really feel that this was good police work on the behalf of the police officers, and that the police officers were acting in the best interest of the citizens of Homer and the state of Alaska when they went out and contacted Mr. Reichel outside the bar. They were being vigilant and observant, and that's what I think the citizens ask of us as police officers in the state. After contacting Mr. Reichel outside the bar, basically what happened there is they detained Mr. Reichel for a moment. But first, before they actually made contact, the police officer went so far as to call their local dispatch and confirm that Mr. Reichel was on probation and that one of his conditions for his probation was not to be in a bar and not to consume alcohol. Then they made contact with Mr. Reichel. They detained Mr. Reichel there while they made phone calls to try and contact his parole officer. And in doing so, finally got a hold of the parole officer. It took about 20 minutes to do that. They did get a hold of the parole officer. The parole officer advised them to go ahead and arrest Mr. Reichel. And then they did arrest Mr. Reichel right at that point and did a pat-down search of him incident to the arrest. During that pat-down search, they located cocaine on Mr. Reichel's person, and he ended up being charged for that violation as well. That subsequently now has been reversed, and so what we really need is we need the ability to have our police officers take this kind of action immediately without having to jump through extra hoops in order to arrest a parolee or probation officer. Presently, the procedure that we would have to follow would be to observe Mr. Reichel in the bar, document that he left, was in the bar, had been drinking, and then later contact his parole officer, give him the information. He would have to write a report, and then he would then try and seek a warrant for Mr. Reichel's arrest. Subsequently, then we would have to go and find Mr. Reichel again, and then we could arrest him for the probation violation. This situation unfolded in a community where the police officers had ready availability to get a hold of the probation or parole officer. Had this occurred in a village setting, may well have been a different set of circumstances here. And there are scenarios where a violation of parole or probation could create an imminent public danger or involve a recent or serious harm to persons or property. We need our police officers to have the ability to take care of these situations on the spot without these extra procedures to follow. Thank you.
And Vanessa provided a copy of this case on your desk for those that want to read through it, the Reichel case. There's a big stack of cases, so it's at the back. Representative Grunberg.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Lieutenant, you're referring, your testimony relates pretty much solely to Section 31. Is that correct?
I believe 26, 30, and 31.
26, 30.
The Chair, I'm sorry.
An answer. Representative Guerra? Being quiet. Okay, any further questions? Thank you, Lieutenant.
I do, if I may. I'm sorry, I'm behind in my homework. I haven't read the bill here. Is police officer defined somewhere?
Police officer? I believe it is. I'd probably defer to Department of Law on that for the moment.
What I'm wondering is the term, there is a term, if I recall, and I'm asking Mr. Nowros also this, law enforcement officer, I think, is a term that's used. And I see the bill uses the term police officer, and I'm wondering if that's more narrow than law enforcement officer. Would it might be too narrow because you might want a brown shirt having that power, too. Is that a police officer?
Through the chair to Representative Ruhlenberg, I believe it also says a police officer certified by the Alaska Police Standards Council, which would then cover all those police officers as well.
I see. Yes, sir.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you, Lieutenant Sharp.
Thank you.
Okay, next I have Susan Parks. Then I'm going to go to Linda Wilson, as I said before, and Josh Fink. And I don't have anyone from Corrections signed up, so if Corrections intends to testify, then sign up. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Susan Parks. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division, and it's a pleasure to be here with you this afternoon. I'd like to thank Representative McGuire and Representative Samuels for introducing this bill and holding hearings so early in the session. I think from what you heard from both Ms. Nielsen and Ms. Fendini, this is a critical issue for our criminal justice system, and timely attention is appreciated. You may hear testimony or comments that we're rushing this bill through the legislature. The truth is that this has been in the making since June of 2004 when the Blakely case came out. Since June of 2004, our felony sentencing law has been in flux, in chaos. We're getting conflicting rulings from Superior Court judges across the state. We're taking multiple appeals. We're not getting any finality or certainty for defendants, for victims in cases, and so I applaud the swift action in the session to take care of this problem. The Department of Law has been studying this problem since June. We've been meeting with legislators. I've had some meetings with the public defender and OPA since this happened. I think this bill is well thought out and well crafted, and I urge your support of it. The bill before you, I believe, offers a balanced approach to Blakely. Blakely, as Ms. Tondini indicated, doesn't dictate how to comply with the case. There are several options, but I believe that this bill offers a balanced approach given our current sentencing structure and brings our current structure into compliance with Blakely in a way that maintains some of what is the best part of our sentencing structure. To put the bill in perspective, I just wanted to mention what Ms. Tondini already mentioned, was that we went to presumptive sentencing because of disparity in sentencing before judges did have wide open discretion. And under Blakely, we could go back to that system. The Blakely decision would allow judges to have wide open discretion. It's once you set a presumptive sentence, though, that aggravators must go to a jury. Judges can't make that decision anymore. I believe that maintaining non-disparity in sentences is a good goal and a goal that the legislature should strive for, and I think that this bill gives some discretion to judges while keeping a system in place to maintain conforming sentences and not having disparate sentences.
Yes, Representative Kira.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Susan, I just want to make sure, every time I think I understand Blakely, then I'm not sure that I really understand it, so.
Well, it's a 5-4 split, so, you know, it's.
Explain to me just the logic so I can understand Blakely better, that says a judge could impose a 5-year sentence or even a 10-year sentence or even a 15-year sentence if the judge personally finds aggravated conduct, but that you have to go to a jury if an aggravator is used. How is that any difference? A judge finds aggravated conduct. It's conduct that the jury wasn't charged to find. Like, let's say the offense is for assault. And let's say the judge decides, well, God, this assault involved a dangerous instrument. And so the judge, because it involved a dangerous instrument, imposes a longer sentence. The jury was only charged to find whether or not there was an assault, so the jury didn't make a finding that there was a dangerous instrument. So this is legal under Blakely, it seems, that the judge finds this extra finding that there was a dangerous instrument, it's okay for the judge to impose a longer sentence. But if there were an aggravator that said, if the crime involves a dangerous instrument, and the jury hasn't found that aggravator, you couldn't do it, right?
The way, through the chair, Representative Guerra, the way that it's easiest for me to think about it is, it has to do with the expectations of the defendant. And once the legislature sets sentences that gives a defendant an expectation that this sentence is the sentence he or she will get absent additional factual findings, then you run into a Blakely problem. In Washington, it was a range. There was a range that this defendant had an expectation. This was the maximum sentence that he could get based on the plea he entered. And if there's facts that allow you to go beyond that expected range or set sentence in our case, then it has to be a jury finding. If the expectation of the defendant is it's wide open sentencing, 0 to 20, the judge can give you anything, then that's the expectation, and you don't have a Blakely problem. Does that answer the question?
I think so. So does Blakely say that if you give the judge the discretion to impose a sentence between 5 and 10 years, let's say we give the judge the discretion to impose a sentence between 5 and 10 years, presumably 10 years it's because it's worse conduct, 5 years it's because it's not such worse conduct. It's okay even though the judge really is making findings, he or she's just not announcing them?
Well, through the chair, Senator Representative Guerra, that is in fact what we're proposing with this bill. And to give the judge a range of sentences, much like Washington had and many other states use presumptive ranges. This is not an unusual scenario. What the judge should do, as a judge should do with any sentence, like when they have wide open, is to look at Title 12, which lays out what we refer to as the Cheney criteria, which came from a case, but the legislature put them in statute to guide judges, and those refer the judges to what they are supposed to look at in setting any sentence. And just if I can find it, you probably have it in your packet. It's at the beginning of 1255, and it talks about the declaration of purpose. For example, a judge right now, for misdemeanors, there's no presumptives. For murder in the first degree, there's no presumptives. A judge doesn't have to make factual findings. They're supposed to look at the purpose behind a sentence and set a sentence within that range available that meets the declaration of purpose.
055005?
Correct. Seriousness of the defendant's present offense in relation to other offenses, prior criminal history of defendant, likelihood of rehabilitation, the need to confine the defendant to prevent further harm to the public, circumstances of the offense and the extent to which the offense harmed the victim or endangered the public, the effect of the sentence to be imposed in deterring the defendant or other members of society, the effect of the sentence to be imposed as a community condemnation, restoration of the victim and the community. So those are sort of guiding principles that a judge should always look at in deciding what an appropriate sentence is. And under this bill, rather than having to make factual findings like aggravators, mitigators, the judge is being given a range. The judge needs to look at these principles in deciding where in that range this person's appropriate sentence would be.
Follow up, Representative Guerra? Further questions? Representative Grunberg.
I'd like to go back to the little area that Lieutenant Sharp was talking about, and I'd like the members to look at page 19 of the CS. I'm just working off of that, if I may, Madam Chair. It allows the police to arrest if there's an apparent violation of certain types of conditions. And it seems that the intent is to deal with, and I'm looking at lines 30 and 31, conduct that creates an imminent public danger or threatens serious harm to persons or property. Yet it seems that some of the previously enumerated five categories wouldn't appear to be limited in that manner. For example, it's difficult for me offhand to see how simply operating or driving a motor vehicle would necessarily create an imminent public danger. And I'm wondering whether there was an intent. Well, first of all, my two questions are, why under current law can't police officers arrest for a probation or a parole violation? What was the policy behind denying them that right? And secondly, I realize this is a compound question. Secondly, whether there's a reason for going beyond conduct that would necessarily create a public danger.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg. As far as public policy, I don't know that there was a conscious public policy made to not allow police officers to arrest. It simply isn't enumerated in the statutes to give them that authority. And that's what we're trying to do. And I guess I'd like to point out in Section 26, and in the Reichel case, the problem there wasn't the arrest, because once they'd spoken to the parole officer and gotten authority to arrest, they could make the arrest, and that's how it works now. The problem, if you read the case, was the stop. The court said they couldn't stop him and contact him to sort of explore whether there was a violation going on, because there was no imminent public danger or threat in him just being in the bar. Now, those officers, because it's a small town and they know everybody, knew he wasn't supposed to be there, and in fact, I believe he was on felony parole for felony DUI. So the real intent is first to give officers the ability, if they have reasonable suspicion that there's a violation, to be able to make contact. And then once they make the contact, if they then have probable cause to believe there's been a violation of any of these enumerated, they have the authority to make the arrest. I mean, obviously, if someone's committing a new crime, which is a violation of probation or parole, police have the authority to make that kind of arrest. It's these things like geographic limitations. He's in a bar, he's drinking. That's not a crime normally for anyone, but if you're on felony parole or probation for DUI, it is, and this simply gives them the ability to make a stop on reasonable suspicion, establish probable cause, and make an arrest. And I just, if I could just follow up, there is a definition of police officer in the statutes that under Title 18 that includes airport police, police of municipalities or the state, and so it's a pretty all-encompassing definition.
Madam Chair, is there a difference between that and law enforcement officer?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, it may be a term of art. I think the critical part here is to have someone who is certified, the Alaska Police Standards Council. I think you're ensuring that only certified police officers are being given this.
Are there police officers who are non-certified?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, there could be tribal police officers, for example, or unincorporated, areas that hire.
Village safety officers?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, correct, although my understanding is that village public safety officers have already been given this authority through a separate statutory authority, which is unusual.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Just to supplement to the confusion, my House Bill 91 last year giving peace officers 20-year medical retirement, which you assisted with, adds another definition, which firemen are included in that one. So it would be good to get a handle on exactly. We know what the intent is, but I think there are three different definitions floating out there.
That's a good point. We may want to narrow that further within the bill itself. Representative Kira.
Madam Chair, I can take this up later. I want to cut to the main chase of the bill, and I can do it later because maybe you want to present a few more things before we get there. But I think my understanding is everybody else's understanding in the room, which is after Blakely, our sentencing scheme was declared unconstitutional. And what Ms. Parks is trying to do, what the chair is trying to do, is come up with a sentencing scheme that comes up with essentially the same sentences we authorized before, but in a way that satisfies the law. There's no intention here to increase the sentences. There's no intention here to decrease the sentences. We're trying to come up with a way to come up with essentially the same sentences, but in a way that's legal and feasible and efficient. Is that fair?
Through the chair, that I believe is the intent of the bill.
And just the flip side is, I mean, I think it would be wrong for us to start changing sentences unless we went into each crime and determined what the appropriate sentence would be for that crime. But if we're just going to do a blanket change to the sentencing scheme, we should be trying to come up with sentences that are same as what we've determined as a matter of policy they should be. My fear, and I'm going to propose a fix, my fear is that by taking, there are many sentences under current law that, let's say, are four-year sentences. The term is 4 years unless some of the 30-some-odd aggravators are found. And if the aggravators are found or mitigators are found, then you can go up or down from 4 years. And what it does is it takes, for example, a four-year sentence, it takes that and it turns that into a sentence that a judge can impose a 4 to 7 year sentence with no findings. And then if you want to go above 7 years, a jury has to find some of those 30-some-odd aggravators. And if you want to go below 4 years, the judge can find some of the mitigators and go below. But in this area where there is no findings by the judge, you go from current law, which is if there are no findings, it's just a 4 year sentence. And now we're going to this new law that says if there are no findings, it becomes a 4 to 7 year sentence. My concern is that with no findings by the judge, we're giving judges the discretion to impose longer than a 4 year sentence with no findings, with no ability for the public to hold judges accountable for why they're doing this, with no way to gain any insight from the judges for why one kid who does something gets a 4 year sentence and another kid of a different race or a different background gets a 7 year sentence, and we have no idea why it's happening. My concern is that is this part of the law of the bill that says judges can now increase their sentence with no findings at all, and my worry is that's going to increase the basic sentence without any of the aggravators being found.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the Senate Judiciary shared your concern, and there was testimony that in fact people felt that this was going to across the board just increase sentences, and they did draft a letter of intent that made it clear that was not the intent of the legislature, unless of course you do look at these ranges and decide we as a body decide these are too low and want to increase them. So I think that's certainly something this committee should take a look at, the letter of intent, and may want to draft a letter of intent yourselves as well to make clear your intention. What has happened with Blakely is the balance of power has been forced to change, and you see this as giving judges all kinds of new discretion to just up sentences. Judges had all kinds of discretion and power under our old sentencing scheme that's been taken away. We're trying to give a little bit back with these ranges to bring back the balance of power. Under the scheme that's unconstitutional, judges not only made the findings of fact themselves about aggravators, they made them only by clear and convincing evidence, and then they decided whether it justified increasing a sentence or not. Under Blakely, juries have to make the finding. They have to make them beyond a reasonable doubt. The judge still will have the power to increase a sentence or not. I think it's important to remember that just because a judge or a jury finds an aggravator, it does not require that a sentence be increased. just as a mitigator, doesn't require that a sentence be decreased. I mean, we've given our judges that discretion already. Our system had that. I don't believe that this is a huge sweeping change from that. It's giving them some of that discretion back that they're losing because we're going to this higher standard of proof and we're going to juries. My expectation is, frankly, that you're going to have a lot fewer aggravators proposed because appropriate sentences are going to be available in these ranges without having to propose aggravators, without having to go to a jury trial.
Representative Guerra.
I can just go one more step backwards just to, and then I'll start moving forwards. But what Blakely said, and the most obvious way to change the sentencing scheme to meet Blakely, but many people think it might be too expensive, would be you still, if we had a four-year sentence before as a presumptive, it's a four-year sentence now. If you want anything bigger than 4 years, what Blakely says is you go to a jury and you ask the jury to make the findings on these aggravators. The DA's office makes a fair case that doesn't result in a flexible enough sentencing system. But that's what Kansas has done, I think. Somebody.
Through the chair, Kansas has that system. Kansas also has ranges of sentences. And I can tell you that the Kansas prosecutor who presented at a conference, just if you don't mind me adding here, there was a Vera Institute sentencing conference that I attended, Barbara Brink from the Public Defender attended, Portia Park from DOC attended, Heather Brakes attended. We had a presentation from the Kansas prosecutor. They have ranges, they have aggravators that have to go to a jury, and he said of the 105 county prosecutors across the state, 100 of them were not using aggravators. So the system is in place, but it's not being used.
Let me get to my proposed fix. I'd like you to comment on it. My big problem is not with giving judges some discretion to go above the presumptive term. My big problem is giving judges secret discretion. Discretion that, with a black robe, without mentioning what you're doing, without giving anybody a clue, one judge can impose a longer sentence without saying why, one judge can impose a shorter sentence without saying why. It sort of runs afoul, number one, of our original intent when we came up with presumptive sentencing, which is we didn't want this disparity of sentences between judges. But now with your proposal, with no findings whatsoever, you can have two different sentences for the same crime. And all I think we need to do is to give the judges the discretion the state wants to give them, is to say, if you want the sentence between 4 and 7 years, that's fine. The judge can impose that under the same standards that you propose, 0-0-5 standards. Judge can use those same standards that you propose to do the sentence 4 to 7 years, but if the judge is going to do anything other than that presumptive 4, if the judge is going to go a day longer than the presumptive 4, the judge just has to say why. The judge has to issue a finding. The benefits of those, that will be a few. One, I don't like this unaccountability that we encourage by letting judges do things without telling us why. I don't like the disparity that I'm sure will at some point develop, where one judge will be allowed by this law under the same circumstances to give somebody, one kid, a much longer sentence than another kid. And with the findings, then judges and prosecutors and defense attorneys we'll have a record of what kinds of things justify a year longer sentence or a 2 year longer sentence, and they can point to the findings in the prior cases. So I think it'll help with uniformity. I think it'll help with transparency. I think it'll help with accountability. And I think it'll still leave you this flexibility. If you want to make a 4 year sentence, what is now a 4 year sentence, a 4 to 7 year sentence, and we tell the judge, look, if you find that this is anything other than a garden variety, whatever that crime is, just tell us why, and you can go up to 7 years. I think it meets everybody's concerns. But without it, we've got this sort of cloak of secrecy that I really worry about.
through the chair, Representative Garrett, that's certainly a policy call of this body and requiring judges to make findings under 1255-005 certainly could be inserted into this bill. I would urge, if you're going to do that, to only require it orally, not in writing, because judges don't normally make that. Would be a big burden on them. One of the concerns, and this was discussed in the Senate, Section 7 of the bill deals with the appellate rights. And one of the concerns about requiring findings is that the Court of Appeals then is going to be pretty active in determining appropriate sentences. And Section 7 is proposed because it's really the legislature's purview to set appropriate sentences for certain crimes. And what Section 7 does, this is on page 4, I think, basically says that if a judge imposes a sentence within the range set by the legislature, it can't be reversed as excessive. Now, if there's some kind of procedural problem or an evidentiary problem, obviously it can get reversed. The concern is here that the legislature isn't setting sentences anymore. The Court of Appeals is, and so if you determine these ranges are appropriate, do you want to require certain magic words that have to be spoken to have those upheld as not excessive? So that's the concern.
Interesting dialogue. Representative Bloomberg.
Just on this last point, and again, I'm professing my ignorance on the bill. Section 7. It says that a sentence reviewed by the appellate court or by the superior court may not be reversed as excessive if it's within the applicable presumptive range. Now, it seems to me that this is kind of a bifurcated proceeding now. Most of these aggravators require a factual finding. But once the finder of fact makes that factual finding, then it becomes the province of the judge to determine what the sentence should be. I've got grave concerns just at first with the language in the bill, because it has nothing to do necessarily with the correctness of the factual finding. It impinges on the current judge's discretion as to whether to apply the factual finding in the given case, or whether the application, which is within the judge's discretion and within the purview of the judiciary under the separation of powers doctrine. And I have some questions as to whether this violates the separation of powers doctrine, because we're not dealing with the factual finding here necessarily. We're dealing with the judge's application of the aggravator and the discretion of the judge, which is within the core of the judiciary's function under the separation of powers doctrine. Don't you think that runs afoul of the separation of powers doctrine?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I guess I apologize. I'm not sure I understand your question. What this is only talking about a sentence within the range.
I understand that.
And so you think that runs afoul of the doctrine?
I think it could, because a sentence, even though it's within the range, might be held by the appellate court to be excessive under the facts of the case. And to limit that discretion would seem perilously close to violating the separation of powers doctrine.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I don't share that concern. In fact, this question came up in Senate Judiciary, and we researched that. I personally researched it. I relied on some people in our appellate section, and there may be people who disagree, but In fact, it is the legislature's authority and province and right to set sentences. Now, certainly judges then impose those sentences, but you as a legislative body have the authority to set sentences for crimes. That's what you do. That's what you did with presumptive sentencing. And there's a Supreme Court case, and I can give you the cite. It's Bear v. State, where the Supreme Court of Alaska held that they didn't even have the authority to review sentences for excessiveness because the legislature, unless it's, you know, cruel and unusual punishment, something like that, the legislature, that was your job. And in fact, the legislature, in response to that case, gave them statutory authority to review sentences. You created the Court of Appeals, which is a statutorily created court, and you gave them statutory authority to review sentences. This Bear case has been cited most recently in a case a couple of years ago, Rosickdahl, and I can get you that cite as well. The legislature passed a statute that limited felony sentence appeals only to people who had sentences of 2 years or more. If you got less than 2 years, you couldn't appeal your sentence as excessive. A gentleman appealed that as, you know, the legislature can't do that. I can appeal my sentence. And in fact, the court upheld, yes, in fact, the legislature can determine appropriate sentences and they can limit what sentences can be appealed.
Through the chair, if I may.
Representative Grunberg.
At this point, well, not being familiar with those cases yet, I'll accept as correct for the purpose of our discussion your interpretation. On a policy basis, why should this legislature limit a judge's appellate court's discretion to determine whether the sentence is excessive? Are the judges abusing their discretion now? Is there a reason we should take away their current power?
Through the chair, I believe the concern and why this was included in this bill is a concern that there may be a lot of frivolous appeals. That in that we are creating ranges. We're going from you know what was 5 years to 5 to 8, and anyone who gets more than 5 may decide to appeal as excessive because it's over the 5. And do you want to, should the courts deal with all those appeals, even though they're within a range that you, the legislature, has determined for an A felony offense, 5 to 8 years is an appropriate sentence? You have the authority as a policy matter to say, those are frivolous appeals. Those are within the range we think is appropriate and we have set, and if you get more than 8, you can appeal it as excessive, but you get between 5 and 8, that's a policy call for the legislature.
Representative Guerra?
I think I can address this appeal issue and the issue of my concern of judges making no findings but upping sentences, both in one sentence, and we can talk about the proposed amendment later on, but I dash it off to everybody's desks. My view is we have this Supreme Court opinion to deal with. What we want to do is keep our sentencing structure as similar as possible to what it is right now in a way that meets the court's guidelines. Right now, if a judge imposes more than the presumptive term, the judge has to issue findings. So I've said a few minutes ago, I want the judge to issue findings within this presumptive range that we've come up with. And right now, the law says if a judge does anything other than that presumptive term, it can go up to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals can determine whether or not the extra amount of years is fair or not fair. I still want to keep the right to appeal as well. If you don't, then what you're telling a judge that you can issue a sentence between 4 and 7 years, you can do it for any reason you want, and it's not appealable. A judge could theoretically write, I imposed a 7-year sentence because I wanted to. It's not appealable. And that's why you do have the right to an appeal. And current law allows you, if you're going to go anywhere over 4, to have a right to appeal. I think these Cheney factors that are codified in 005 have always been subject to appeal in the past. I think it would be a pretty large departure today to say you could have a 3-year longer sentence, a sentence 75% longer, with no right to an appeal. And so what I would like to see would be for the state to get the benefit it's looking for, which is a longer sentence without having to go through an extra jury trial. And I understand why you want that, and I want to give you that, because I think there are some valid reasons for why you want that. So we'll let you avoid the jury trial to get a longer sentence, but I think the longer sentence should be appealable, and I think there should be findings. And as long as you do that, this new 4-7 range where it used to be a 4-year sentence doesn't bother me. A new 5-8 year sentence where it used to be a 5-year sentence doesn't bother me, because there's accountability and there's a right to an appeal. And the benefit of an appeal, among many other things, is you have individual trial judges who don't speak to each other every day, who are dealing with similar cases, and they don't know what the other person is doing. That's the purpose of an appeals court, is to look at what the lower courts are doing and come up with a uniform rule so they know how to do it uniformly in the future. I mean, it works. So I guess what would be your objection to, if you're going to allow for a longer sentence and we're going to give you this benefit of doing the longer sentence without the separate jury trial, which is what the state wants, what would be wrong with letting a judge review the longer sentence on appeal?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, first let me just clarify. This doesn't say you can't appeal. It actually just says it can't be reversed as excessive. So if you had inappropriate remarks being made by a judge, or again, evidence coming in at a sentencing that shouldn't have come in, or evidence that should have been considered, this doesn't say you can't appeal. It simply says it may not be reversed as excessive within that range. Again, this is a policy call for the legislature. My concern is that there's going to be a slew of appeals because of these ranges. That's certainly something that the legislature, we could be back here next year saying, how's this new system working, and talk about it then and see if, you know, some tweaking is necessary, and maybe that's what you decide you want to do. I also would also just say the ranges aren't really being requested to the benefit of prosecutors. We think it actually is a benefit to the public and the system, and brings back balance to a system without imposing on our judiciary and our courts and our juries, and gets the appropriate sentences in a more efficient way.
And I, through the chair, I didn't mean to say that it was being done for the prosecution. With a system that I said I'd agree with, I agree with. I mean, I think it makes sense, and for the reasons that you're proposing it. So.
Yeah, it's that delicate balance, because this is a very bold, clear statement, and if you make the caveat that you require a finding in order to go beyond the presumptive sentence, it gives that opportunity to raise a question about whether that finding was appropriate, about whether or not it should be challenged, and there's that potential to bring forward more litigation. But I hear Les's point, and I really do, and I'm glad we got a chance to flesh through it, because there'll be a lot more as we'll start marking this up next week, is my plan. The other bodies bill will come over, and oddly enough, this bill is going to finance next, and so I really want to make sure that we get all the work done in here and have it in a place that we feel comfortable with as a Judiciary Committee before going. So we'll start marking it up on Monday. It's my intent to go ahead and make a decision then about what CS will adopt, whether will we adopt a CS or stick with the original, and then we'll present the amendments at that time. So be thinking about amendments between now and then. And I always appreciate Representative Guerra as it gets a gold star. He always writes them up, and it's a great way to do it. You can write them out on a notepad while you're here, and we'll do the best we can with them, but it's easier if they're written, and so we can see right where they go. With that, I think we've explored all of the different iterations on that point. I'll let Susan continue and wrap up. And then we do have, it's 15 after, we've got 45 minutes left, and we have Linda Wilson and Josh Fink still to testify. So.
I will wrap up quickly, because I'm sure we'll have more discussion. I just wanted to highlight a couple of other items in the bill. The bill is drafted to not require aggravators to go to the grand jury. Grand jury is required for people who are in custody within 10 days of them being in custody. There are often many, many things we don't know about a case that quickly. So in the bill, there's provision for notice prior to trial that the state gives notice to the defense either 10 days prior to trial or at another time set by the court. So if they want to set it to be earlier or if new information comes up at the last minute, giving us the opportunity to give later notice, that allows notice rather than requiring the grand jury.
May I inquire on that point?
Yes, Representative Gruber.
Where is that?
I apologize to not have that at my fingertips.
I'm not trying to delay.
It would be on page 17, section 21. We both set out the aggravators that under Blakely, I think as you heard Ms. Tendini say, other than prior criminal history, these must go to a jury. We believe there's a list of aggravators that rely on prior criminal history that therefore don't have to go to a jury. So this section lays out which aggravating factors don't need to go to the jury and then the timelines for giving notice.
I have a question. Specific question, Madam Chair. Isn't this an amendment of a court rule?
Through the chair, no. I don't believe it is, Representative Gruenberg, because there is no current court rule that requires notice.
I'm not getting into whether it's an amendment or not. My question is, isn't this a change? Isn't this a procedural in nature? And doesn't it therefore change the if it's procedural in nature, doesn't it require a two-thirds vote and notice in the time? I just don't, if you're going to go down this road, and I'm not saying whether it may be excellent to do it, and particularly since you got a bill in the Senate already, you might take a look and see if this is the kind of thing that constitutionally, through the chair, of course, requires notice in the title, two-thirds vote, so that you don't run afoul of that provision. Better to be safe than sorry, through the chair.
Thank you, Representative Gruenberg. Then the only other sort of additional things that I think were mentioned briefly by Ms. Nielsen, there is an aggravator that is added in the bill on page 15, section 19. Currently, there is our presumptive sentences are based on prior felony convictions. And there's no aggravator for someone who, for example, has a lengthy misdemeanor criminal history. This allows an aggravator to be found based on five or more A misdemeanor convictions. The thought there being that someone with no misdemeanor priors maybe should be treated differently than someone who has a long misdemeanor criminal history. That gives the judge that discretion. The other change that was discussed was on periodic sentencing, limits periodic sentencing, and DOC can go into the problems that periodic sentencing can create for DOC and some of the inequities that happen with periodic sentencing. This would limit the circumstances and kinds of sentences that would be eligible for periodic sentencing. On section 6, page 4, codifies a current practice where judges often give what's referred to as general condition of probation 12, which is it gives the probation officer during the course of probation to give special instructions or rules to the probationer as new things happen that require it. I think the example Ms. Parker has used in the past has to do with setting curfews or geographic limits as problems may arise during the probation period. This codifies the judge's ability to delegate that to probation officers. And then finally was the discussion that we had with Lieutenant Sharp about giving police officers the authority to stop probationers and parolees on reasonable suspicion that they are violating their conditions.
Representative Groom.
Just one question. We've been given by Ms. Tondini excellent sample of the cases, like there's the one case, the Reichel case. Are there any other sections in here that, I mean a real section?
There is one.
Oh,
that's what
I was saying. Okay. I was just saying we need a sectional on this. Apparently there's
one. It's in your bill pack.
Oh, in the, okay, well, we'll find it. I don't seem to have that. Okay, thank you. Are there any other sections in this bill that are in response to one particular case? Because I always find it helpful if we're legislating in response to a case to see what the case says. Is there anything else that's like Reichel?
Yes. There's a case called Husky, which is actually an MOJ from the Court of Appeals, which prompted the proposal to codify allowing judges to delegate to probation officers some authority. Is that in the
cases?
Oh, okay, that's in that packet.
Thanks to Doug Woolver.
Oh, now this.
Thank you, Mr. Woolver.
We have the camera panned to Doug Woolver.
Thank you, Doug. Okay.
Ask and ye shall receive.
I see.
There's okay. Not enough paper on this committee.
There's not enough paper.
And this relates to giving probationer a probation officer.
Thanks. That refers to Section 6, which allows judges to delegate to probation officers the ability to give special instructions during the course of the probation period.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Hey, thank you very much, Ms. Parks. We appreciate your hard work on this. Okay. Linda Wilson, my apologies. We drug on a little long. And then Josh Fink, I hope you're still standing by.
I am.
Okay. Linda.
Yes. Good afternoon. This is Linda Wilson, Deputy Director of the Public Defender Agency. Thank you for allowing me to testify on House Bill 78 before you today. Wanted to also thank Law for working with us and keeping us abreast of their efforts after the Blakely decision came out. As Clark said, we did have an opportunity to meet with them. And Ms. Brink did go to Denver to the Vera Institute meeting and was allowed to participate once she got there. So we certainly do appreciate them then conferring with us. None of our suggestions, however, were put into this bill. That should not diminish our thanks for at least being consulted. Vanessa has gone over sort of the history of the cases that have brought us to today. It started back in 2000 with Apprendi, and she's given you the holding in that case, and then what Blakely said as a result of that sort of clarified what that maximum sentence meant, and it meant was based upon what a jury found or what a defendant admitted to in their plea. What these two cases really deal with, though, is respecting the Sixth Amendment, and I think Vanessa said that pretty clearly. In Scalia's decision in Blakely, I think he said it well, and he does like to go back and talk to the framers, but really this is about honoring our Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial, that it's a jury that should be making these types of findings. Okay. So I want to quote you the last sentence, basically, of Scalia's in his opinion. The framers would not have thought it too much to demand that before depriving a man of 3 more years of his liberty, the state should suffer the modest inconvenience of submitting his accusation the unanimous suffrage of 12 of his equal neighbors rather than a lone employee of the state, referring to Mr. Blakely in this case, who got 3 more years added on to the sentence when he was expecting to receive a sentence within a 4-month range of between 49 months and 53 months. That lone employee of the state, that's the judge. So it's really about respecting the right to a jury. That's what Blakely was all about. When the recent case came down last week, Booker and Fanfan, there was an interesting, which then said, yes, Blakely applied to the federal sentencing guidelines. Again, it went back to respecting the fifth, you know, your Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial. And there was, in the defense that came from Blakely, Justice O'Connor specifically mentioned Alaska's presumptive sentencing scheme, and I think there were 9 states that had sentencing schemes that then became vulnerable because of Blakely. There was concern by dissenting members of the court that this is going to throw everything in chaos, it's going to cost more money, there's going to be inefficiencies, those types of concerns. And Justice Stevens in Booker, I want to read another quote from him, referring back to the decision by Scalia in Blakely. We recognize that in some cases, jury fact-finding may impair the most expedient and efficient sentencing of defendants. But the interest in fairness and reliability protected by the right to a jury trial, a common law right that defendants enjoyed for centuries and that is now enshrined in the Sixth Amendment, has always outweighed the interest in concluding trials swiftly. So let's not forget what Blakely is all about. Blakely is about honoring and respecting your Sixth Amendment right to have a jury decide those facts that put you in a higher exposure to a sentence. So now let's go and look at what we have in Alaska and our Alaska sentencing history. Prior to 1978, we had indeterminate sentencing. And as a result of that, there was disparity. And so in 1978, we instituted this presumptive sentencing scheme. And the goal of that was to eliminate unjust disparity and to have some reasonable uniformity in our sentences. How has that worked? Well, interestingly enough, the Judicial Council was recommended to do a study. In 1997, the Alaska Supreme Court Advisory Committee on Fairness and Access recommended that the state assess the relationship between defendants' ethnicities and their treatment in the justice system, the criminal justice system specifically, to see, are we doing a good job at having uniformity and proportionality and certainty and fairness in our sentences for all offenders? So the Judicial Council examined felony cases from 1999 and did a study and a report on those. And I believe last year you were probably presented with the results of this report since they came out last year. And the Judicial Council found that there really was no systemic ethnic discrimination in the imposition of sentences, and there wasn't a lot of disparity in presumptive sentencing that would be associated with ethnicity, gender, type of attorney, and location. So as far as presumptive sentencing was going, it was doing a good job of providing uniformity. So that was a good thing. I faxed over to you, and I hope that you have it in front of you.
She just distributed it.
From the Judicial Council report.
Linda, she just distributed it.
Oh, good. Okay. But I wanted to highlight for you what they found is that there's certainly a majority of the cases that face presumptive sentencing. The vast number that get the presumptive sentence, because that presumptive sentence in Alaska is a specific number, so it's either 4 years, 5 years, 8 years, there's uniformity there. And so of the 55% of the defendants that get presumptive sentencing, there's not an opportunity for disparity within that percent. And then there, of the sentences that they studied, there were a certain percent that was aggravated. So what this bill addresses is that percent of the presumptive cases that actually get aggravated. And now Blakely said you have to have a jury decide that factual finding that takes you, that aggravating fact that takes you above the presumptive. Certainly what the state is proposing, or what the sponsors of this bill is proposing, is one solution to Blakely. Another solution that could be to go back to indeterminate sentencing. That has its own problems. The other possibility is to go to, is to just embrace Blakely and leave our presumptive sentencing scheme the way it is, but provide for a jury trial for aggravators that require a factual finding that's not based on a prior conviction. That was something that is also a very viable possibility. The disinclination to go that way, however, is, I think, partly because of the cost and wanting to have more flexibility. But with flexibility, it gives the judge more discretion, and that's the worrisome part of this proposed bill, is that it's too broad. I think it gives too much. But if you look, and the reason I say that is because now what was a presumptive 5 now is between 5 and 8. What was a presumptive 4 is now a range of 4 to 7. What was a presumptive 2 is now a range of 2 to 5 and 2 to 4. So we have ranges that are either expand 2 years all the way up to 10 years. So these ranges are not narrow. They could be narrower. They are not that narrow under this proposed scheme. And that allows for disparity. My biggest fear is that sentences are going to go up. They are just going to increase. And the reason I put this table in front of you is to just show you where Alaska is in relationship to other states nationwide, because that was something that the Judiciary Council looked at in that 99 report. Alaska has, in terms of the percent of incarceration, if that compares to nationally, if convicted felons are sentenced, what part of them get incarceration and what part get probationary time? And Alaska beats out the rest of the country in terms of the percent that are incarcerated. So we are already a state that over-incarcerates in comparison to other states. And that you know, not to say that there's anything terribly wrong with that, if that's what this legislature wants to do. But I think we call into question what's going to happen as a result of this bill when you leave those ranges open and as broad as they are, that the sentences in Alaska are going to increase. Even with intent language that you don't want to do that, with those sections in the bill, particularly Section 7, that says, you have no right to appeal. And by saying, well, oh, the court just won't reverse the excessive, well, if the court can't reverse the excessive, then why would you appeal? It virtually takes away your right to appeal because there's no remedy available to you. So it sort of makes the appeal fairly meaningless. So the remedy in this bill, I think, is too broad. If the goal is to keep our uniform sentencing scheme intact as much as possible with the goal of eliminating unjust disparity, it does too much because there's now an opportunity to have greater disparity within that range. So instead of embracing Blakely and embracing rights to a jury trial, respecting the Sixth Amendment, this bill attempts to circumvent Blakely and find a way around honoring and respecting that right, but finding a way to make it constitutional, but not really embracing it. Most of it probably will comply, but I think what we're going to find is that the sentences are going to go up. There's nothing in here that says the judge needs to stick to the bottom end of that range. And I think the suggestions that Representative Garrett made about if you really don't want to increase the sentences, then why not allow a defendant to appeal something beyond that low end of the range as excessive and allow there to be some review? Right now in Section 7, there's absolutely no review. So somebody could get a 7-year sentence and somebody could get a 4-year sentence, and there's nobody checking. There's no ability to check on that and have that reviewed and accountable. So the judges from one part of the state will know. And there's good things about reported case law, so that the judges who are in the trenches can compare and find out what this goes for. And then you also are looking at the Cheney criteria that has been codified in Section 005 and giving that some substance. So those seem to be good things. On the particular parts of the bill that are problematic, I'd like to at least call your attention to some of them. On page 4 of the bill that has to do with allowing a probation officer to add additional conditions without having to go back to court, I've consulted with one of our online attorneys who is a former probation officer. Her name is Lynn Jones, and she's also the attorney in our Anchorage office who exclusively handles petitions to revoke probation. So she's an attorney who has been a prior probation officer working for the Department of Corrections and is now an attorney representing people on probation facing petitions to revoke probation. I wanted to express her concerns to me about this part of the bill. What she says happens often is if a probation officer changes or adds an additional condition to the terms of probation, many times the defendant has no idea that they have any ability to challenge that additional condition, and that it doesn't come up until they get violated for violating that condition of probation, and they go back into court, and then they find, after having an attorney or challenging it, that they could have done that after they've been on that extra condition for perhaps a year. So what might be a good way to address that concern, and I know that it had been amended in Senate Judiciary, the version you're looking at, if you look at the Senate version, because they added the word orally, which would be a good thing, that you certainly provide the inmate or the defendant in writing and orally about this additional condition. And it says in there the additional condition is binding upon delivery until modified by the court. But there's nothing in here that says that the probation officer should advise the defendant that they have that they can request judicial review of this additional condition. And so maybe that adding that provision in there, that after you give them notice orally and in writing, you include in that notice that the defendant can request judicial review of the additional condition. So at least there's an opportunity for that defendant to bring it back into court and let the court decide, does this additional condition have anything to do with the crime that you committed? Is it reasonably related to the offense and the offender, that it promotes rehabilitation and fits it? So there is some judicial review. And then certainly in the meantime, that additional condition is binding, and it gives the probation officer the flexibility, but it also allows the defendant an opportunity and notice that they can go back into court and have the court review this new condition. In terms of the right to a sentence appeal and whether or not it's excessive on the in looking at Section 7, since we're on the same page, if you were not to propose the amendment or look at the language that Representative Guerra has suggested about if you go over the minimum end of the range, then the judge has to make findings under 1255.005 and justify the upward enhancement within the range, then maybe you could also consider making the ranges smaller. Our presumptive sentences were a specific number of years. Now making them ranges, we are allowing for more disparity within that range. If we reduce the range to something smaller, then maybe it makes more sense and you really aren't trying to do that. But I actually think Representative Garrett suggested of allowing there to be review by a court of appeals is a good thing, because if you just leave it the way it is now, you can have judges impose sentences at the high end of the range and there is no review. And that just I can't imagine that that really is the goal, and I fear that that's what will happen. And then we will be back in a situation where perhaps people of color and certain ethnicity are going to be at the high end of the range, and wealthy people who have a private counsel that has one sentencing a month they're going to be at the low end of the range, and that causes concern. That probation condition that was added, going back to Section 6, they talk about the Husky decision. And if you look at the Husky decision, I think the state in that case conceded that it should get rid of that general condition number 12. So I find it interesting that in that case they conceded that it was perhaps an unfair delegation of authority, but yet now are wanting it to be included. Going to page...
Linda, just...
I know that this part...
Representative Guerra wants to jump in.
Excuse me?
Representative Guerra wants to jump in.
Okay, sure.
Thanks. Linda, I don't understand the part you're talking about on page 4 perfectly. So page 4, section 6, it says that the additional probation condition can be ordered. On line 4, it says, if ordered by the court, but then on line 8, it says, until modified by the court. So are we letting probation officers impose new conditions until a court says that wasn't proper, or are we waiting for there to be some court order justifying the new probation condition before it gets imposed?
It's a little bit of both. Through the chair, Representative Guerra, this, as mentioned in the prior testimony, there's a general condition number 12 that you see in probationary orders where the judge delegates authority to the probation officer. Let me pull up that decision. I can read you what a probation 12 would look like. So the general condition number 12 would read, abide by any special instructions given by the court or any of its duly authorized officers, including probation officers of the Department of Corrections. So that general condition 12 is sort of a delegation of authority to the probation officer to come up with any special instructions. So that has been interpreted to be additional conditions. And what isn't in here, though, is that a judge can always review conditions of probation. You can go back in and try to modify or change your conditions of probation. The length of your term of probation, that's something that a court can always come back and review during the term of your probation. So first of all, the judge would have to order this condition that would be implemented, that it would delegate some authority. But this would allow a probation officer, because this was called into question in Husky about is this an unfair delegation of authority, they want to keep this special condition 12 as long as they advise, if they make any special instructions or new things that they have to do, like, you know, sometimes it's go to a treatment center or do, you know, UAs, or that wasn't spelled out in the original condition, or when you were put on probation. This would allow, what I was mentioning is that you advise the defendant when you give him these special instructions or additional conditions that you have the right to go back and request review.
So, Linda, are all you asking for is something in here to say that if this happens, you also tell the defendant they have a right to seek counsel and review?
Yes.
But if I take the other position, if there's this condition number 12 that's imposed as a condition of probation, and so at sentencing the defendant is told, and look, your probation officer might add new conditions, isn't the attorney at that point telling the defendant, look, the probation officer might impose additional conditions. If that happens, you have a right to appeal. Right, isn't that happening at the time of sentencing? So why should we say that should happen again?
Well, you could challenge that at the time of sentencing, but if something came along down the road, what this is talking about is things that come on later during the course of probation, that something comes up that they want to add an additional condition, and oftentimes the defendant doesn't know that they have the ability to go back into court and have the court review the conditions that are imposed. So this allows that to, if you put in there that, that you advise them of their opportunity to go back in and request review, then at least they're informed, the probation officer is able to quickly implement some special instruction until the time that they can get in front of the court if the defendant wants to go back in front of the court. Maybe the defendant is fine with the additional condition, doesn't have a problem with it. Well, then there's no reason to go back into court.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
So what I'd like to do is
Representative Gruenberg?
Ms. Wilson?
Yes.
Just on this point so the members can follow along. If the members will bring out their Husky opinion, we just got that. On pages 3 and 4 is what Ms. Wilson and Representative Garrett have been talking about. Probation condition 12 is set out in footnote 6 in the middle of the right-hand column, and the probation of the condition for probation number 7 on the search was in footnote 4 on the left-hand column. But, Ms. Wilson, I'd like to turn to the Husky opinion on the last page, the portion that is of the text that accompanies footnote 15. And it says that the Supreme Court has recognized that probation officers have common law authority, and decisions from other jurisdictions recognize that a probation officer has inherent authority, that is, to set additional probation conditions, as long as the exercise of that discretion does not impinge on a judicial responsibility, that is, as long as the court has not improperly delegated its authority to the probation officer. And I read that as having constitutional underpinnings, that if we have a judge who imposes the sentence, that only the judge can exercise his own authority. And can't delegate it entirely away. And I'm concerned, Ms. Wilson, through the chair, that the language in the bill, page 4, lines 3 and 5, down to 5, if ordered by the court to abide by additional conditions of probation imposed by the defendant's probation officer, that does not, by its terms, contain any such limitation. Are you not concerned, through the chair, Ms. Wilson, that that could be unconstitutionally broad?
Well, through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, it does give me concern, yes. I mean, and certainly a probation officer cannot set restitution, and that's an example where the court couldn't delegate to the probation officer. Here, the probation officer can decide what the fine is going to be or what the restitution is going to be. That would be clearly impinging on the judge's responsibility in the case. So that would be an improper delegation of authority. So I mean, there are risks in this, yes. And they do cause concern. But at least the concerns about giving the defendant the ability to get back into court, that causes me concern too when they don't provide them notice with their opportunity to do that. So
thank you. We can
so
pursue through the chair. We can pursue this further. I have a lot of questions about the bill, and that happens to just be one of them. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure. If we were to go to page 17, section 21 of the bill, that has to do with the factors in aggravation at sentencing, and on line 12 to 13, it lists those 8 aggravators that the state, that this bill says does not have to be proved to a jury beyond reasonable doubt. That it only has to be proved by clear and convincing evidence. I think there's going to be a lot of dispute about whether all of these aggravating factors really are based on a prior conviction. As we go back to the Apprendi case, what that said, except for the fact of a prior conviction. So these aggravators, and if we look at some of them in particular, let's look at C7. And if you go on page 12 of the bill, C7 is the aggravator that says prior felony conviction for the purposes of invoking the presumptive range was of a more serious class of offense. So that requires an extra finding that the prior is of a more serious nature. So that factual finding could very well need to come under the Blakely purview and need to be found by a jury beyond a reasonable doubt.
May I inquire on that?
It's CH. The defendant's prior criminal history includes conduct involving aggravated or repeated instances of assaultive behavior. This is not an aggravator just based on a prior conviction. You need to make extra factual findings that there was aggravated conduct, repeated conduct. You look at subsection 12, the aggravator. The defendant was on release from another felony conviction. So that extra fact of them being on release needs to be found. I don't think there's any question that C15, C19, and the new one, 31, probably are based on just prior convictions. But a number of these require additional facts, including 20 and 21, whether the defendant was on furlough or on parole or probation. So that's an extra fact. 21, criminal history of repeated instances similar in nature, so you've got to make a finding of similarity to the present offense. So those extra facts, I think, call into question whether or not these particular aggravating factors need only be found by clear and convincing evidence. So there will be challenges to those aggravators if they're included in that under Blakely. I don't think that this will comply with Blakely, and those need to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt.
Can I ask a question?
Representative Grunberg?
Very, very briefly, through the chair. Number 7, which was the first one you mentioned, that does not seem to be, through the chair, Ms. Wilson, to be a question of fact, but a question of law. You have a conviction, which is on the record, and the question is whether it was of a more serious class of offense than the present offense. Is that not a question of law rather than a question of fact?
Well, I think it's debatable. I think it could be a question of fact as well, because you might have a conviction from another state, so you've got to then determine whether that conviction from another state, where that would compare to what we have in Alaska, is it of a more serious nature or not? So I don't think it's simply law. I think it's probably a mixed question.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, we've got 5 more minutes.
Sure. So the last thing I had to talk about, and I wanted to just review for you, is what I think this is going to do. I think what we're going to see is there are going to be challenges to this bill. I think there's going to be a challenge to the bill on taking away your right to a grand jury on the aggravators. That's in section 1 of the bill that says, and I think the Parks had mentioned that there's no indictment on aggravators. My guess is that that is going to be challenged. Not my guess, I'm sure it's going to be challenged. I also think what we're going to see is that there's going to be this disparity in the ranges, and where before a defendant who received a presumptive sentence is now going to see an increase in that sentence, and there's going to probably be a lot more defendants put on probation during that, if not getting a longer sentence of active terms of imprisonment. They're certainly going to be put on probation for the upward reaches of that range. And as a result of that, you're going to see more petitions to revoke probation because, you know, whenever you put more people on probation, there's more chance that there's going to be revocations of those for violations while they're on probation. And so I think we're going to see higher sentences, more people on probation, more violations of probation, more people being incarcerated for that. We're also going to occasionally see, now I don't know that it's going to happen that often, Ms. Park predicts that it's going to be a very rare event that a jury is going to decide an aggravating factor. With this range, it certainly makes the jury less likely that that's going to be found. Is that really the intent of Blakely? It doesn't embrace Blakely. Blakely is all about your right to a jury trial. And this really circumvents it. So I think it does more than it needs to, and those are the concerns. I do think it's good that the legislature sets a fix to this and makes it effective immediately, so that it's not waiting. So I think that's a good change. Those are all my comments, and if you have any questions, I'm certainly available, and I will be listening in for the rest of your committee hearings on this bill. This is an important bill.
Okay, thank you, Linda. Josh, we're at the hour. I'm sorry, but members have other meetings that they have to get to. So what I'll do is put you at the very top of the hour on Wednesday. And my deepest apologies, we are in receipt of your amendments that you offered, and I don't have a problem with them at all, and we'll offer them as chair. But we'll go ahead and start marking up the bill Wednesday, and we'll take your testimony at the top of the hour.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Josh. Okay, with that, committee is adjourned. Yes.
We need some additional.